Walk on, miles beyond Ralph and the river. The canyon changes a little in character, in places growing wider, less deep, with breaks in the wall and steeply pitched ravines that seem to suggest the possibility of an exit to the world above. I make two attempts to climb out of the canyon, but the first route dead ends at the foot of another vertical cliff, and the second at a deep, stagnant plunge pool swarming with tadpoles and dragonflies. Above this pool is an overhanging drop-off down the center of which 1,000 years of intermittent drainage has scooped out a pothole and then drilled clear through it, creating a long polished chute and a window in the rock. But there are many of these moor-like formations, hundreds of them in the canyon country. Late in the evening, the sun already down, I find what looks like a deer path leading up over an alluvium hill toward the southwest rim. I am tempted to take it and see where it goes, but I am also hungry, tired, and a bit sore-footed. My raisins are all gone, and the canyon grows dark. Sadly, I turn and start the long walk back. Long before I come again to the second of the dripping springs, night has covered the desert world. I sit down on a driftwood log, build a small fire with shreds of its bark, wait for moonrise. I put the boots back on. Water or no water, my feet have suffered enough. The new moon finally comes, edging above the rim rock, bright as a silver shield. Through moonlight and darkness, as the moon is revealed, then concealed by the turning of the canyon walls, I continue the march toward camp. For company on the way, I have my thoughts and the flutterings and cries of a great horned owl that chooses, for reasons of its own, to follow me for much of the distance. The return is harder than I expected. If I didn't have the stream to follow, Ariadne's thread, it would be easy in the deceptive alternation of moonlight and shadow to take a wrong turn up one of the many side canyons, to spend the rest of the night in bewildered wandering or go to sleep on an empty stomach, covered only with my back. The repeated wading of the stream seems doubly tiring now, especially as the boots become water-soaked and layered with quicksand. I trudge onward, longing for the first sight of Ralph's campfire, hoping that each new bend in the canyon will be the last. The Escalante is no longer the free and friendly place it was during the day, but totally different, strange, unknown and unknowable, faintly malevolent. Endless, too, I'm beginning to feel, before I see at long last the glimmer of coals ahead, the embers of a fire, and in the dimness the outline of the rubber boats. A comforting sight. Ralph is sleeping when I stumble into camp, but wakes up easily to show me the mess of catfish he has caught, cleaned, and saved for me, wrapped in wet leaves, still cool and fresh. It's surely after midnight, but who wants to sleep? We rebuild the fire and deep-fry the fish and part of the bacon grease which Ralph has wisely been hoarding all along. I pull off my mud-caked boots, twice their original weight, sit close to the fire, and eat a tremendous supper, while Newcomb fills the air with huge clouds of fragrant, philosophical pipe smoke. We discuss the day's adventures. High above our heads the owl hoots under the lost moon. A pre-dawn wind comes sifting and sighing through the cottonwood trees. The sound of their dry, papery leaves is like the murmur of distant water, or like the whispering of ghosts in an ancient, sacrosanct, condemned cathedral. Late in the morning, close to noon, the sun comes glowering over the wall in a burst of fire, and we are driven out of our sacks. Into the green lagoon for a bath and a swim, and then Ralph baits a hook with the reliable rotten salami. I build a campfire in the shade and fill the skillet with grease, and once again we dine on channel cat. Delicious fish. After this combined breakfast and dinner, we retire to the water again and deeper shade, evading the worst of the midday heat. Naked as savages, we float on our backs in the still water, squat on the cool sand under the sheltering cottonwood and smoke like sachems. We may not have brought enough food, but at least we've got plenty of Bull Durham. "Newcomb, I explain. We've got to go back. But why? He says. Why? Why do you grow that beard? Why not? Well, why? Well, why not? Well, goddammit, why? Well, goddammit, why not? Because, I explain. The role of the explainer has become a well-established one in recent times. Because they need us. Because civilization needs us. What civilization? He says. You said it. That's why they need us. But do we need them? Well, I say, how long do you think that jar of bacon grease will last? That made him think. Let's go, he says. Sometime in the middle of the afternoon, we shove our fragile boats once more into the water, climb aboard and paddle slowly out of Escalante's womb, back to the greater world of Glen Canyon and the steady, powerful, unhurried, insouciant Colorado. It is almost like a coming home. For the rest of the afternoon, keeping to the shady side, we drift down the splendid river, deeper and deeper and deeper into the fantastic. The sandstone walls rise higher than ever before, 1,000, 2,000 feet above the water, rounding off on top as half-domes and capitals, golden and glowing in the sunlight, a deep, radiant red in the shade. Beyond those mighty forms we catch occasional glimpses of eroded remnants, tapering spires, balanced rocks on pillars, mushroom rocks, rocks shaped like hamburgers, rocks like piles of melted pies, arches, bridges, potholes, grottos, all the infinite variety of hill and hole and hollow to which sandstone lends itself, given the necessary conditions and, as Thoreau says, a liberal allowance of time. Let us say about 5,000 years, 50,000, 500,000. Choose whatever sum you like. We pass beneath hanging canyons, the mouths of lateral drainages which terminate above the level of the Colorado. Out of these, when it storms, come roaring falls of thick muddy water, of logs, trees, cows, and thundering boulders, all crashing into the river hundreds of feet below, a gorgeous spectacle which we will not have the good fortune to witness. Now and then we are offered tantalizing views, far ahead, of the blue dome of Navajo Mountain, another laccolith, a holy place, home of gods, navel of the world in the eyes of the Indians, and the ship-like prow of the high Kaiparowits Plateau. Not all is rock. We see a red-tailed hawk skimming along the cliff, once a golden eagle, and vultures soar in the distance. Closer by, we hear, though seldom see, the wrens, finches, and yellow warblers, and a few long-legged water birds. Heart of the whole and essence of the scene is the river, the flowing river with its thin fringe of green, the vital element in what would be otherwise a glamorous but moon-dead landscape. The living river, and the living river alone, gives coherence and significance, and therefore beauty to the canyon world. I love all things which flow, said the deepest of Irishmen. At evening, we come to a historic hole in the rock. Here we float ashore and camp for the night. What happened here? In the year 1880, 11 years after Powell had passed this way, the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints commissioned a group of the faithful, living in then south-central Utah, to establish a new settlement in the southeast corner of the state, near what is now the village of Bluff. As obedient as they were courageous, some 250 Mormons, men, women, and children, with livestock and 26 wagons, started east from Panguitch toward the designated place. They followed no road or trail, but simply what would have seemed, on a map, to be the shortest line between the two points. After traversing 70 miles of desert, they came to the rim, the jump-off. 2,000 feet below, the Colorado River rolled across their chosen route. Instead of giving up and turning back, they hammered and blasted a notch, the hole in the rock, down through the rim into the nearest side canyon. From there, they carved and constructed a crude wagon road to the edge of the water and descended. In places, the wagons had to be lowered on ropes. After fording the river, these undaunted people climbed the farther side over terrain almost as difficult, and continued on, week after week, through the surreal sandstone wilderness and forests of pinon and juniper, until they reached their goal. The entire expedition required about 4 months. The trail which they pioneered was never used a second time. In the morning, I decided to climb the old trail up through the notch to the top of the plateau. I haven't seen the outer world for a long time now. While Ralph goes fishing, I start off through the willow jungle, around tangles of poison ivy, and up enormous sand dunes toward the hole. A brook trickles down the gulch below the path, a thread of water creeping from pool to pool. At the final opportunity, last chance puddle, I take a hearty drink. I've left my canteen behind at the boats. Hole in the rock, clearly visible from the river, doesn't seem far away. The old trail climbs away from the water, switchbacking up the tailless slope on the northern side of the canyon. The pitch is steep, the morning sun is blazing on my back, and the heat quickly becomes unpleasant. My sweat dries as fast as it forms. The parched air is sucking at my pores. My belly is full of water, gurgling like a wineskin, but I can almost feel it being drawn away. The knowledge that I've brought no canteen along adds poignancy to my premature thirst. I put a pebble in my mouth and keep climbing. Above the talus I find the dugway, broad and shallow steps chipped out of the canyon wall by the first and only road builders here, and the remains of fill and foundation, slabs and blocks of sandstone laid in place one by one over 80 years before. The canyon begins to narrow and pucker near the summit, and the cleft is jammed with boulders big as boxcars. I squeeze among them, following the tracks of former hikers. Here at least is shade, though no water. I sit down to rest, daydreaming of iced limeade, chilled tomato juice, Moorish fountains. The temperature out in the sun must be well over 100 degrees. Upward. Under a ledge I find the barest hint of a seep, drops of moisture leaking from the rock and dampening the sand beneath. I am so thirsty by this time that I try digging a water hole, but the deeper I go, the drier the sand. I need water. I put some of the moist sand into my mouth, extracting what refreshment I can from it, and go on. Up through the notch. I come out on the surface of a rolling plain of cross-bedded sandstone, the petrified dunes of the Navajo Formation, and win the view I'd been hoping for. Far in the distance lie the blue ranges under hard-edged snowy cumulus clouds. The Henrys, Elk Ridge, and the Bear's Ears beyond White Canyon, 10,000-foot Navajo Mountain on the other side of the river. On the west, not so far, perhaps 10 miles away, rises the Kaparowitz Plateau, also known as 50 Mile Mesa, another island in the sky, little known and uninhabited, cut off on all sides but the north by its sheer vertical walls. I walk out onto a point from which I can look down at the river, nearly straight below. I can see the switchbacks of the trail, the fan of greenery at the outlet of the side canyon, but no sign of Newcomb or the boats, deep in the shade of the willows. From up here, the sound of the river, until now a permanent part of my auditory background, is no longer perceptible, and the desert silence takes on a deeper dimension. The sound of nothingness? In the desert, wrote Balzac somewhere, there is all and there is nothing. God is there, and man is not. God? Nothing moves but the heat waves, rising from the naked rock. It is somehow comforting to see nearby the yuccas growing from the sand and from joints in the stone. They are in full bloom today, clusters of waxy, creamy flowers on tall stalks, supported and nourished by the rosettes of dagger-like leaves that form the base of the plant. God, I think, quibbling with Balzac. In Newcomb's terms, who the hell is he? There is nothing here, at the moment, but me in the desert, and that's the truth. Why confuse the issue by dragging in a superfluous entity? Occam's razor. Beyond atheism, non-theism. I am not an atheist, but an earthiest. Be true to the earth. Far off, the muted kettledrums of thunder. Pianissimo. T.S. Eliot and The Wasteland. Certain passages in that professorial poem still appeal to me, for they remind me of Moab, Utah. In other words, I like the poem for the wrong reasons and dislike it for the right ones. Here I am relaxing into memories of ancient books, a surefire sign of spiritual fatigue. That screen of words, that veil of ideas issuing from the brain like a sort of mental smog that keeps getting between a man and the world, obscuring vision. Maya. Time to go back down to the river and reality. Back to Newcomb and the boats, the smell of frying catfish. There's God for you. I descend. Evening on the river, a night of moonlight and canyon winds, sleep and the awakening. In a blue dawn under the faintest of stars, we break our fast, pack our gear and launch the boats again. Farther still into the visionary world of Glen Canyon, talking somewhat less than before, for what is there to say? I think we've about said it all. We communicate less in words and more in direct denotation. The glance, the pointing hand, the subtle nuances of pipe smoke, the tilt of a wilted hat brim. Configurations are beginning to fade, distinctions shading off into blended amalgams of man and man, men and water, water and rock. Who is Ralph Newcomb, I say? Who is he? Aye, he says. And who is who? Which is which? Quite, I agree. We are merging, molecules getting mixed. Talk about intersubjectivity. We are both taking on the coloration of river and canyon, our skin as mahogany as the water on the shady side, our clothing coated with silt, our bare feet caked with mud and tough as lizard skin, our whiskers bleached as the sand, even our eyeballs, what little you can see of them between the lids, have taken on a coral pink, the color of the dunes. And we smell, I suppose, like catfish. We've forgotten to keep a close track of time, have no clock or calendar, and no longer know for certain exactly how many days and nights we've been on the river. 6, I think, he says, my doppelganger. No, only 5. 5? Let's see. No. Yes. Maybe. I believe. 7? 4? The time passes very slowly, but not slowly enough. The canyon world becomes each hour more beautiful the closer we come to its end. We think we have forgotten, but we cannot forget. The knowledge is lodged like strontium in the marrow of our bones, that Glen Canyon has been condemned. We refuse to think about it. We dare not think about it, for if we did, we'd be eating our hearts, chewing our entrails, consuming ourselves in the fury of helpless rage, of helpless outrage. We pass the mouth of a large river entering the Colorado from the east, the San Juan. Somewhere not far beyond this confluence, if I recall my Powell rightly, is the opening to what he named Music Temple. We keep watch, but see a dozen lovely and mysterious grottos, all equally beguiling, pass up some, let the current rush us by others, and finally end up by choosing the wrong one. We will not have another opportunity. When Old Shady sings us a song at night, wrote Powell in 1869, we are pleased to find that this hollow in the rock is filled with sweet sounds. It was doubtless made for an academy of music by its storm-born architect. so we name it Music Temple. Less than a century later, his discovery will be buried under the mud of the reservoir, rendered inaccessible by those who claim they are not only developing but also opening up the canyon country. What have we lost? Here is Powell's description of the place. On entering, we find a little grove of box elder and cottonwood trees, and turning to the right, we find ourselves in a vast chamber carved out of rock. At the upper end, there is a clear, deep pool of water, bordered with verdure. Standing by the side of this, we can see the grove at the entrance. The chamber is more than 200 feet high, 500 feet long, and 200 feet wide. Through the ceiling and on through the rock for 1,000 feet above, there is a narrow, winding skylight, and this is all carved out by a little stream which runs only during the few showers that fall now and then in this arid country. Late that evening, after sundown, Ralph and I beach our boats and make camp on a sandy spit near the outlet of a deep, narrow, labyrinthine side canyon, its name, if it has a name, unknown to us. I explore part of its length in the twilight and find another charming stream with pools of remarkable beauty, crystal-clear water in basins of rock and sand, free of weeds or mud, harboring schools of minnows. Darkness sets in before I can go very far. I go back to the campfire. After a splendid night, clouds like clipper ships racing across the starry sky, moon floating along the brink of the crag above us, wind in the tamarisk, we make a quick breakfast and I return to the exploration of the hidden passage, taking the canteens with me to fill with fresh water. I come to where I had turned back the night before, a deep pool that fills the canyon from wall to wall. Filling the canteens, I cache them nearby, undress and wade into the water. The pool is deep, over my head. I swim across it, following a turn in the narrow canyon, here no more than 10 feet wide, and emerge beyond into a curving tunnel of rock with running water on its floor. This natural tunnel is pure rock, completely devoid of sand, soil, and any trace of vegetation. The walls that tower above are so close to one another, overhanging and interlocking, that I cannot see the sky. Through a golden glow of indirect reflected sunlight, I proceed until I come to a very large grotto or chamber, somewhat like the one described by Powell, where a plunge pool and waterfall check any further advance. Here the canyon walls are a little wider, permitting the sun, for perhaps a couple of hours during the summer day, to shine directly down into this cul-de-sac. A rivulet of clear water pours into the pool. Glints and flecks of light reflected from its agitated surface dance over the dark golden walls of the glen. Lichens are growing there, green, red, orange, and along the seep line are beds of poison ivy, scarlet monkey flower, maidenhair fern, death commas, helleborine orchid, and small pale yellow columbines. There are no trees or shrubs, for the sunlight is too brief. The sun is gleaming on the pool, on the foam, on the transparent waterfall. I dive in, swim under the fall, and take a soapless shower, lie on the rock in a patch of sunshine, and gaze up at the small, irregular fragment of blue which forms the sky in this place. Then I return through the tunnel to camp and companion. Has this particular canyon been seen and named by earlier river runners? No doubt it has, but I find no evidence to dispel the illusion that I may be the first ever to have entered here, and probably the last. After a lunch of refried pinto beans and dehydrated apricots, a piquant combination, we climb into our double boat and float onward. Since we have missed Music Temple, I am more determined than ever that we must not pass Forbidden Canyon and the trail to Rainbow Bridge, climax and culmination of any trip into Glen Canyon. We stay close to the south and east shore of the river, despite the ferocious afternoon sun, investigating each side canyon that we come to. In one of these, I accidentally start a brush fire and am nearly cooked alive. Sheer carelessness, A gust of wind carries a flaming piece of paper into the dried-out tangle of a willow thicket. The flames spread explosively. In a minute the mouth of the canyon is choked with smoke and fire, and there is nothing I can do but get out of there, quick, as the flames rush down through the jungle toward Ralph, waiting for me in the tethered boats. He is all ready to cast off when I appear, about 10 feet in front of the onrushing sheet of fire, running. I push the boats off and roll in. We paddle away as hard as we can from the fiery shore, the final wild flare of heat. With generous tact, Ralph does not even ask for an explanation. You can see a photograph of what I did in Elliot Porter's beautiful book on Glen Canyon, The Place That No One Knew. "Hot in there," I say, though Ralph has asked no questions. "So I noticed. Had an accident. Is that right?" Shakily, I tamp my pipe and fumble through the pockets of my shirt. All gone. "Here," he says. "Have a match." The river carries us past more side canyons, each of which I inspect for signs of a trail, a clue to Rainbow Bridge. But find nothing so far, though we know we're getting close. We can see in the canyon distance, not far ahead, the southern tip of the Kaiparowits Plateau, the landmark to guide by when seeking the way to Rainbow Bridge. We bounce over a series of minor ripples, and the river picks up speed. There is a corresponding excitement in the sky. The storm that has seemed potential for days is gathering above in definite form. Wild gray scuds of vapor, anvil-headed cumuli nimbi, rumbles of thunder coming closer. From up ahead comes the familiar freight train roar of Whitewater again. A new and formidable canyon opens on the left, with a broad delta of pebbled beach, mud banks, rocks and boulders and driftwood issuing fanwise from its mouth. The boulders, carried down from the flanks of Navajo Mountain, cause the rapids which lie before us. A little wiser now, learning from experience, we do not battle the current, but rest until we are close to the rapids, then with a sudden furious effort paddle into the backwash near the shore, and have no trouble making a landing in the shallows. Ralph starts supper. I pull on boots and go exploring. I find a trail, but it's a poor one, little more than a deer path, which peters out completely a mile up canyon. There are ponds of fresh water on the canyon floor. I refill the canteens and return to the boats. The wind by this time has risen to a magnificent howl. The sky is purple, and jags of lightning strike at Navajo Point, the remote crag 2,000 feet above the river on the north side. Cold rain spatters on the hot sand of the beach, raising little puffs of dust and steam. Rock and driftwood and the flashing underside of leaves gleam with a strange, wild, shifting light from the stormy sky. We rig the tarpaulins into a tent, preparing for rain, and eat our supper of pancakes on which we pour a sauce of stewed raisins in place of the syrup we haven't got. Very good. Filling, anyhow. Afterwards, tea and tobacco. We sit outside our tent, enjoying the weather. After a week of clear skies and the heat and glare of the relentless sun, the cool wind and the sprinkling of hard, cold raindrops on our bare heads and bare bodies feel good. The heavy rain we've been anticipating fails to come. We pile our baggage onto the canvas shelter and unroll our sleeping bags in a hollow among the white dunes, under the open sky. Falling asleep, I see a handful of stars blinking through a break in the racing clouds. A red dawn in the east, cloud banks on fire with the rising sun. I bathe in the cold river, do my laundry, and build a fire for our breakfast. Dried pea soup and tea bags. The last box of raisins I have set aside for lunch. Stores seem to be getting low. From now on it'll be catfish or nothing. On to the river, and through the whirlpools we glide without mishap into quiet water. Our little boats are holding up well. Despite all the rocks we've bounced them off and over, despite the sand and snags we've dragged them over, they have yet to sustain a puncture or spring a single leak. Aye, but the voyage is not over. Shouldn't mention these things. Within a short distance, we come to another big tributary canyon on the port side or southerly shore of the river. Navajo Point, the final outcropping of the Kaiparowits Plateau, is directly overhead. This canyon, too, has tumbled boulders into the river, forming one more stretch of rough water. As before, we take advantage of the eddies close to the rapids, swinging briefly upstream and then into the flooded mouth of the side canyon. We tie up on a mud bank and get out to investigate. At once I spot the unmistakable signs of tourist culture. Tin cans and tinfoil dumped in a fireplace, a dirty sock dangling from a bush, a worn-out tennis shoe in the bottom of a clear spring, gum wrappers, cigarette butts, and bottle caps everywhere. This must be it, the way to Rainbow Bridge. It appears that we may have come too late. Slabivius Americanus has been here first. Well, no matter. We had expected this. We know with certainty that we are now only a few hours, by motorboat, from the Glen Canyon Dam site. I also happen to know that the natural bridge itself is still 6 miles up the canyon by foot trail, a distance regarded as semi-astronomical by the standard breed of mechanized tourist. His spoor will not be seen much beyond the campground. We set up a camp of our own well beyond the motorboater's midden, near the little stream that tumbles down the rocky canyon floor, coming from the great Red Rock wilderness beyond. The trail to Rainbow Bridge, passing close by, is rough, rocky, primitive. Newcomb, who has brought no boots, decides to go fishing. We divide the box of raisins and the last of the dried apricots. I stuff my share into my shirt pockets and lace up the boots, hang a canteen over my shoulder, and march off. The trail leads beside the clear-running brook and a chain of emerald pools, some of them big enough to go swimming in. With the water so transparent, I can see the shadows of the schools of minnows passing over the grains of sand in the bottom of the basins. Along the canyon walls are the seeps and springs that feed the stream, each with the characteristic clinging gardens of mosses, ferns, and wildflowers. Above and beyond the rim rock, blue in shadow and amber-gold in light, are alcoves, domes, and royal arches, part of the sandstone flanks of Navajo Mountain. A hot day. Delicate, wind-whipped clouds flow across the burning blue, moving in perfect unison like the fish in the pools below. I stop at one of the largest of these pools, undress and plunge in. Happily I flounder about, terrifying the minnows, and float on my back and spout cheekfuls of water at the sun. On to the bridge. I come to a fork in the canyon, the main branch continuing to the right, a deep, dark, narrow defile opening to the left. There are no trail markers, but even on the naked sandstone I can make out the passage of human feet, boot-shod, leading into the unlikely passage on the left. And so I follow. Here, too, a stream is flowing, much smaller than the other, through smoothly sculptured grooves, scoops, and potholes in the rock. I go by the dripping little springs that feed it, and the stream diminishes to a rill, to a trickle, to a series of stagnant waterholes shrinking under the sun. Frogs and toads will be croaking here, fireflies winking, when I return. Hot and tired, I stop in the shade of an overhanging ledge and take a drink from my canteen. Resting, I listen to the deep, dead stillness of the canyon. No wind or breeze, no birds, no running water, no sound of any kind but the stir of my own breathing. Alone in the silence, I understand for a moment the dread which many feel in the presence of primeval desert, the unconscious fear which compels them to tame, alter, or destroy what they cannot understand, to reduce the wild and prehuman to human dimensions. Anything rather than confront directly the anti-human, that other world which frightens not through danger or hostility, but in something far worse, its implacable indifference. Out of the shade, into the heat. I tramp on through the winding gorge, through the harsh, brittle silence. In this arid atmosphere, sounds do not fade, echo, or die softly, but are extinguished suddenly, sharply, without the slightest hint of reverberation. The clash of rock against rock is like a shot, abrupt, exaggerated, toneless. I round the next bend in the canyon, and all at once, quite unexpectedly, there it is, the Bridge of Stone. Quite unexpectedly, I write. Why? Certainly I had faith. I knew the bridge would be here, against all odds. And I knew well enough what it would look like. We've all seen the pictures of it 100 times. Nor am I disappointed in that vague way we often feel, coming at last upon a long-imagined spectacle. Rainbow Bridge seems neither less nor greater than what I had foreseen. My second sensation is the feeling of guilt. Newcomb. Why did I not insist on his coming? Why did I not grab him by the long strands of his savage beard and haul him up the trail, bearing him when necessary like Christopher would across the stream, stumbling from stone to stone, and dump him finally under the bridge, leaving him there to rot or to crawl back to the river if he could? No man could have asked for a lovelier defenestration. Through God's window into eternity. Oh, well. I climb to the foot of the east buttress and sign for Ralph and myself in the visitor's register. He is the 14,467th, and I the next to enter our names in this book since the first white men came to Rainbow Bridge in 1909. Not many, for a period of more than half a century, in the age above all of publicity. But then it's never been an easy journey. Until now. The new dam, of course, will improve things. If ever filled, it will back water to within sight of the bridge, transforming what was formerly an adventure into a routine motorboat excursion. Those who see it then will not understand that half the beauty of Rainbow Bridge lay in its remoteness, its relative difficulty of access, and in the wilderness surrounding it, of which it was an integral part. When these aspects are removed, the bridge will be no more than an isolated geological oddity, an extension of that museum-like diorama to which industrial tourism tends to reduce the natural world. All things excellent are as difficult as they are rare, said a wise man. If so, what happens to excellence when we eliminate the difficulty and the rarity? Words. Words. The problem makes me thirsty. There is a spring across the canyon, another seep under a ledge below the west footing of the bridge. I climb down and up the other side and help myself to one of the tins someone has left there, collecting water under the dripping moss. The heat is stunning. I rest for a while in the shade, dream and sleep through the worst of the midday glare. When the sun passes beyond the rim, I get up and start to return to Newcomb and our camp, but am diverted by a faint pathway which looks as if it might lead up out of the canyon, above Rainbow Bridge. Late afternoon, the canyon filling with shadows, I should not try it. I take it anyway, climbing a tailless slope and traversing a long inclined bench that pinches out in thin air at the base of a higher cliff. Impossible to go on, but a fixed rope dangles there, hanging from some belaying point out of sight above. I test the rope. It seems to be well anchored, and with its help and a few convenient toeholds and fingerholds, I work my way to the top of the pitch. From there, it's a long but easy scramble to the rim of the canyon. Now I am in the open again, out of the underworld. From up here, Rainbow Bridge, 1,000 feet below, is only a curving ridge of sandstone of no undue importance, a tiny object lost in the vastness and intricacy of the canyon systems, which radiate from the base of Navajo Mountain. Of more interest is the view to the north, east, and west, revealing the general lay of the land through which we have voyaged in our little boats. The sun, close to the horizon, shines through the clear air beneath the cloud layers, illuminating in soft variations of rose, vermilion, umber, slate blue, the complex features and details, defined sharply by shadow, of the Glen Canyon landscape. I can see the square-edged mesas beyond the junction of the San Juan and Colorado, the plateau mountains of south-central Utah, and farthest away, 100 miles or more by line of sight, the five peaks of the Henry Mountains, including Mount Ellsworth near height where our journey began. Off in the east, an isolated storm is boiling over the desert, a mass of lavender clouds bombarding the earth with lightning and trailing curtains of rain. The distance is so great that I cannot hear the thunder. Between here and there, and me and the mountains, is the canyon wilderness, the hoodoo land of spire and pillar and pinnacle, where no man lives, and where the river flows unseen through the blue-black trenches in the rock. Light. Space. Light and space without time, I think, for this is a country with only the slightest traces of human history. In the doctrine of the geologists, with their scheme of ages, eons, and epochs all in flux, as Heraclitus taught, but from the mortally human point of view, the landscape of the Colorado is like a section of eternity. Timeless. In all my years in the canyon country, I have yet to see a rock fall, of its own volition, so to speak, aside from floods. To convince myself of the reality of change, and therefore time, I will sometimes push a stone over the edge of a cliff and watch it descend, and wait, lighting my pipe, for the report of its impact and disintegration to return. Doing my bit to help, of course, aiding natural processes and verifying the hypotheses of geological morphology. But am not entirely convinced. Men come and go, cities rise and fall, whole civilizations appear and disappear. The earth remains, slightly modified. The earth remains, and the heartbreaking beauty where there are no hearts to break. Turning Plato and Hegel on their heads, I sometimes choose to think, no doubt perversely, that man is a dream, thought an illusion, and only rock is real. Rock and sun. Under the desert sun, in that dogmatic clarity, the fables of theology and the myths of classical philosophy dissolve like mist. The air is clean, the rock cuts cruelly into flesh. Shatter the rock, and the odor of flint rises to your nostrils, bitter and sharp. Whirlwinds dance across the salt flats, a pillar of dust by day. The thornbush breaks into flame at night. What does it mean? It means nothing. It is as it is and has no need for meaning. The desert lies beneath and soars beyond any possible human qualification. Therefore, sublime. The sun is touching the fretted tablelands on the west. It seems to bulge a little, to expand for a moment. And then it drops, abruptly, over the edge. I listen for a long time. Through twilight and moonlight I climb down to the rope, down to the ledge, down to the canyon floor below Rainbow Bridge. Bats flicker through the air, fireflies sparkle by the water seeps, and miniature toads with enormous voices clank and grunt and chant at me as I tramp past their ponds down the long trail back to the river, back to campfire and companionship, and a midnight supper. We are close to the end of our journey. In the morning, Ralph and I pack our gear, load the boats, and take a last lingering look at the scene which we know we will never again see as we see it now. The great Colorado River, wild and free, surging past the base of the towering cliffs, roaring through the boulders below the mouth of Forbidden Canyon. Navajo Point and the precipice of Kaiparowits Plateau, thousands of feet above, beyond the inner walls of the canyon, and in the east, ranks of storm-driven cumulus clouds, piled high on one another, gold-trimmed and blazing in the dawn. Ralph takes a photograph, puts the camera back into the waterproof pouch which he hangs across his chest, and climbs into his boat. We shove off. This is the seventh day, or is it the ninth, of our dreamlike voyage. Late in the afternoon, waking from a deep reverie, I observe, as we glide silently by, a pair of ravens roosting on a dead tree near the shore, watching us pass. I wonder where we are. I ask Ralph. He has no idea and cares less, cares only that the journey not yet end. I light up the last of my tobacco and watch the blue smoke curl and twist and vanish over the swirling brown water. We are rounding a bend in the river, and I see far ahead on the left-hand shore something white, rigid, rectangular, out of place. Our boats drift gradually closer, and we see the first billboard ever erected in Glen Canyon. Planted in rocks close to the water, the sign bears a message, and it is meant for us. Attention! You are approaching Glen Canyon Dam Site. All boats must leave river at Cane Creek Landing 1 mile ahead on right. Absolutely no boats allowed in construction zone. Violators will be prosecuted. U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Havasu. One summer I started off to visit for the first time the city of Los Angeles. I was riding with some friends from the University of New Mexico. On the way, we stopped off briefly to roll an old tire into the Grand Canyon. While watching the tire bounce over tall pine trees, tear hell out of a mule train, and disappear with a final grand leap into the inner gorge, I overheard the park ranger standing nearby say a few words about a place called Havasu, or Havasupai, a branch, it seemed, of the Grand Canyon. What I heard made me think that I should see Havasu immediately, before something went wrong somewhere. My friends said they would wait. So I went down into Havasu, 14 miles by trail, and looked things over. When I returned, 5 weeks later, I discovered that the others had gone on to Los Angeles without me. That was 15 years ago, and still I have not seen the fabulous city on the Pacific shore. Perhaps I never will. There's something in the prospect southwest from Barstow which makes one hesitate. Although recently, driving my own truck, I did succeed in penetrating as close as San Bernardino, but was hurled back by what appeared to be clouds of mustard gas rolling in from the west on a very broad front. Thus failed again. It may be, however, that Los Angeles will come to me, will come to all of us, as it must, they say, to all men. But Havasu. Once down in there, it's hard to get out. The trail led across a stream, wide, blue, and deep, like the pure upper reaches of the River Jordan, without a bridge. Dripping wet and making muddy tracks, I entered the village of the Havasupai Indians, where unshod ponies ambled down the only street, and the children laughed, not maliciously, at the sight of the wet white man. I stayed the first night in the lodge the people keep for tourists, a rambling old bungalow with high ceilings, a screened veranda, and large comfortable rooms. When the sun went down, the village went dark, except for kerosene lamps here and there, a few open fires, and a number of lightning bugs or fireflies, which drifted aimlessly up and down Main Street looking for trouble. The next morning I bought a slab of bacon and 6 cans of beans at the village post office, rented a large, comfortable horse, and proceeded farther down the canyon past miniature cornfields, green pastures, swimming pools and waterfalls to the ruins of an old mining camp 5 miles below the village. There I lived, mostly alone, except for the ghosts, for the next 35 days. There was nothing wrong with the Indians. The Supai are a charming, cheerful, completely relaxed and easygoing bunch, all 100 or so of them. But I had no desire to live among them, unless clearly invited to do so, and I wasn't. Even if invited, I might not have accepted. I'm not sure that I care for the idea of strangers examining my daily habits and folkways, studying my language, inspecting my costume, questioning me about my religion, classifying my artifacts, investigating my sexual rights, and evaluating my chances for cultural survival. So I lived alone. The first thing I did was take off my pants, naturally. Next, I unloaded the horse, smacked her on the rump, and sent her back to the village. I carried my food and gear into the best preserved of the old cabins and spread my bedroll on a rusty steel cot. After that came a swim in the pool beneath a great waterfall nearby, 120 feet high, which rolled in mist and thunder over caverns and canopies of solidified travertine. In the evening of that first day below the falls, I lay down to sleep in the cabin. A dark night. The door of the cabin, unlatched, creaked slowly open, although there was no perceptible movement of the air. One firefly flickered in and circled my bacon, suspended from the roof beam on a length of baling wire. Slowly, without visible physical aid, the door groaned shut and opened again. A bat came through one window and went out another, followed by a second firefly, the first scooped up by the bat, and a host of mosquitoes which did not leave. I had no netting, of course, and the air was much too humid and hot for sleeping inside a bag. I got up and wandered around outside for a while, slapping at mosquitoes and thinking. From the distance came the softened roar of the waterfall, that white noise as soothing as hypnosis. I rolled up my sleeping bag and in the filtered light of the stars followed the trail that wound through thickets of cactus and up around ledges to the terrace above the mining camp. The mosquitoes stayed close, but in lessening numbers, it seemed, as I climbed over humps of travertine toward the head of the waterfall. Near the brink of it, 6 feet from the drop-off and the plunge, I found a sandy cove just big enough for my bed. The racing creek, as it soared free over the edge, created a continuous turbulence in the air, sufficient to keep away all flying insects. I slept well that night, and the next day carried the cot to the place and made it my permanent bedroom for the rest of July and all of August. What did I do during those 5 weeks in Eden? Nothing. I did nothing. Or nearly nothing. I caught a few rainbow trout, which grew big, if not numerous, in Havasu Creek. About once a week I put on my pants and walked up to the Indian village to buy bacon, canned beans, and Argentine beef in the little store. That was all the Indians had in stock. To vary my diet, I ordered more exotic foods by telephone from the supermarket in Grand Canyon Village, and these were shipped to me by U.S. mail, delivered twice a week on muleback down the 14-mile trail from Topocoba Hilltop. A little later in the season, I was able to buy sweet corn, figs, and peaches from the supai. At one time, for a period of 3 days, my bowels seemed in danger of falling out, but I recovered. The Indians never came down to my part of the canyon except when guiding occasional tourists to the falls or hunting a stray horse. In late August came the great Havasupai Sacred Peach Festival and 4-day marathon friendship dance, to which I was invited and in which I did participate. There I met Reed Watahomagi, a good man, and Chief Sinyala, and a fellow named Spoonhead, who took me for $5 in a horse race. Somebody fed my pick a half bushel of green figs just before the race, I heard later. The friendship dance, which continued day and night to the rhythm of drums made of old inner tubes stretched over number 10 tomato cans, while ancient medicine men chanted in the background, was perhaps marred, but definitely not interrupted, when a drunken free-for-all exploded between Spoonhead and friends and a group of visiting Hualapai Indians down from the rim. But this, I was told, happened every year. It was a traditional part of the ceremony, sanctified by custom. As Spoonhead told me afterwards, grinning around broken teeth, it's not every day you get a chance to wallop a Hualapai. Or skin a paleface, I reminded him. Yes, the Supai are an excellent tribe, healthy, joyous, and clever. Not only clever, but shrewd. Not only shrewd, but wise. For example, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Bureau of Public Roads, like most government agencies, always meddling, always fretting and itching and sweating for something to do, last year made a joint effort to blast a $1 million road down into Havasu Canyon at no cost whatsoever to the tribe, thus opening their homeland to the riches of motorized tourism. The people of Supai, or at least a majority of them, voted to reject the proposal. And the peach wine flowed freely like the water of the River of Life. When the ball was over, I went home to my bunk on the verge of the waterfall and rested for 2 days. On my feet again, I explored the abandoned silver mines in the canyon walls, found a few sticks of dynamite, but no caps or fuses. Disappointing. But there was nothing in that area anyway that required blowing up. I climbed through the caves that led down to the foot of Mooney Falls, 200 feet. What did I do? There was nothing that had to be done. I listened to the voices, the many voices, vague, distant, but astonishingly human, of Havasu Creek. I heard the doors creak open, the doors creak shut, of the old forgotten cabins where no one with tangible substance or the property of reflecting light ever entered, ever returned. I went native and dreamed away days on the shore of the pool under the waterfall, wandered naked as Adam under the cottonwoods, inspecting my cactus gardens. The days became wild, strange, ambiguous. A sinister element pervaded the flow of time. I lived narcotic hours, in which, like the Taoist Chuang Tse, I worried about butterflies and who was dreaming what. There was a serpent, a red racer, living in the rocks of the spring where I filled my canteens. He was always there, slipping among the stones or pausing to mesmerize me with his suggestive tongue and cloudy, haunted, primeval eyes. Damn his eyes. We got to know each other rather too well, I think. I agonized over the girls I had known and over those I hoped were yet to come. I slipped by degrees into lunacy, me and the moon, and lost to a certain extent the power to distinguish between what was and what was not myself. Looking at my hand, I would see a leaf trembling on a branch, a green leaf. I thought of Debussy, of Keats and Blake and Andrew Marvel. I remembered Tom of Bedlam, and all those lost and never remembered. Who would return?